All right, welcome back to Film Study with Ken McCusick. We're still talking about the tough week. This is going to be episode 8, where we will look at the offensive play of the Ravens in London when they lost 44-7 to the Jacksonville Jaguars. So let's start the show with getting Ken McCusick on. Ken McCusick, how you doing?
Life is good, Josh. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. It's a Steeler week, but nobody's really talking about the fact that we've got the Steelers coming up.
There's a lot of wound licking going on, I agree, and hopefully the Ravens are going to come out and play at a different level. Scott Garceau mentioned something to me the other day. He said that he has a theory that teams come off big losses like this highly motivated, and he expects a real effort from the Ravens. And I certainly hope he's right about that.
Yeah, and the last time the Ravens played the Steelers was that Christmas Day loss last year. So they've got that motivation as well. So hopefully they can focus and really prepare for this game. But we can't look ahead yet because we still got to look back at the performance in London, which Joe is very defensive this week about it, which is not like Joe, but we've been seeing him outspoken and defending his offense this week. So why don't we start just with Joe Flacco?
Sure. Well, it's been a tough season so far for Joe, obviously. It didn't get any easier in London. He had ample time and space on only 7 of 20 dropbacks, so it's not even that many plays. As you know, he was replaced by Mallett late in the game. The Ravens didn't throw the ball that much because they didn't have too many total offensive plays, only 54 total offensive plays, which is very low. But Joe had another tough day and one of the worst days of his career with only 28 yards passing. Once you deduct the sack yardage from that, he's down into the teens, and that was about a little less than 100 yards below his expectation for his opportunity set. So a really awful day for Joe, a bad day for, I think, the receiving talent, a very bad day for the offensive line, as we're going to get to. The only guy on offense who really did much of anything was Alex Collins, and he had an exciting couple series at the end of the game and rolled up some yardage.
Yeah, Alex Collins has done enough that his name is well known in Baltimore now, and it seems like Baltimore is a city where you like the town, people, everyone likes to cheer for the underdog, the no-name guy, the guy off the bench who's coming in that no one expected anything of.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly see that a lot with the Orioles, but yeah, I think that's true with the Ravens too. We appreciate new talent as it comes to the forefront, celebrate it, when it comes on the field and those players do well. And he had an exciting game, and there's hope at the running back situation.
Right. I guess we'll get to, you said he only had 7 shots with ample time and space. It was one of those Sundays where I said, maybe Kaepernick would have done better in this situation.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to be said for that. And I'm not a person who believes in going out and spending the money to get Kaepernick. I think it would be a very, very bad choice at this point. But he is a player who might be more adaptable to a porous offensive line situation where he's going to have to roll and move the pocket a lot to make things happen.
All right. Well, let's get into it. Let's get into the nerdy talk of today's discussion and this pass rush charges and how you score things differently than PFF.
Okay, so I thought each year I'm asked very frequently, how do you score offensive line play and why do your scores differ from PFF seems to be a common thing. And there are a lot of differences between my system and PFF's, but I want to hit on one of the big ones in today's episode, which is the fact that I give out partial pass rush charges. Now, we're going to talk about this as if it applies to sacks, but in point of fact, it applies to pressures and quarterback hits, which are the other two types of pass rush events.
And there were lots of those on Sundays.
Yeah, there were. Unfortunately, there were plenty of them, especially per snap. So, that was something that we didn't want to have happen to Joe. In any case, PFF will always give out a 1 or a 0 as far as a sack goes, and we'll just confine the discussion to that for right now. But it's true for any pass rush event. They'll only give a 1 or a 0 on any given play. So either you get it or you don't. And one of the things that the reasons they give for that methodology is that they're happy to give out 2 sacks on the same play when each of 2 players independently break down and allow a sack. So, for example, if the left tackle and the right tackle on a play both get beat, and PFF judges that independently each of those players would have given up a sack, they each get charged with a sack on that play. That has its own problems. I generally prefer their method for that exact situation.
Okay.
But one of the issues we have is that most sacks aren't simple like that. They don't have one guy beating one guy for a sack. It involves a combination of things. You hear about how important pocket compression is. That'll often contribute to a sack. There'll be some blown stunt pickup where you can't tell which of two players should have picked up the stunt in that situation. Maybe one of them's an eligible receiver, one of them's a lineman, and neither of them got it done, but you don't really know who to blame necessarily for it. You have blocks that cross the pocket in the same way that run plays get blown up, and that, you know, we've gotten better at assigning the defensive player who blows up the play but doesn't make the tackle. We're still not very good at giving pass rush credit and a pass rush charge offsetting that to a player who blows up the pass play by getting a block through the pocket. We had a good example of that in this game.
So you're trying to be a little more focused on who gets blamed, who where the responsibility really falls.
Yeah, that's right, and I'm willing to fine-tune it. So the difference in my system is I can divide that thing in the same way Bitcoin is divided. It's divisible in any way I see fit, and I'll often give it out in as little as a sixth of a sack at a time, because the charge for a sack is minus six. That's a nice round number for me to use, and that usually works, but I'll go even further than that. If four players shared an equal, I'll give them each a minus 1.5 on the play. So I've got whatever tools are at hand to do that. The nice thing about that, and we'll talk to some pros and cons really quickly, is that you have a better chance to get the division of sacks done as well as possible in these complex situations. I guess the second thing is that the total sacks charged will always match the total sacks that occurred. So I don't ever give away two sacks on one play. I give each of two players half a sack, even though in some situations that's not perfect.
Right. Makes sense.
So another thing that is true of a lot of really good offensive linemen is they give up a fair number of contributing elements of sacks, but they're rarely the primary cause of sacks. And Marshall Yanda has been just a beacon of this in his career, is that he gives up some pocket compression occasionally and had occasionally contributed to sacks, but PFF has him on an extraordinary streak of not allowing a sack, whereas during that time he's accumulated about three partial sacks as I score it. So, you know, partial sacks are going to more accurately tag a player who rarely gives up a full sack or even a half sack on his own. And then I think the other thing I just say is, let's say you're going to the grocery store and all you have is a stack of $100 bills. Not a bad situation to be in, except that that's the only currency you can use and there's no change to be made. That's kind of the situation you're in with a one or zero sack method. You either give the player a really awful charge or you give him nothing. But if you had to buy a gallon of milk and that cost $100, you're not going to like that as a rule in general. So, you know, I think you reduce your overall risk of error if you can divide out sacks in a way that makes sense to a prudent man.
Yeah, I that makes a lot of sense. I see the simplicity of a 1-0 system, and just you were good or bad one. But you're right, by doing it and breaking it down a little more like you're doing, for me as a simpleton, it makes a lot more sense that the total number of sacks matches what the game had, and then it does allow you to see how much it really affected that guy.
Right. And it's unfortunate because PFF, you know, I've been in contact with those guys since they began their scoring system, in contact with Neil Hornsby and other people there. And they wanted to do it this way originally, and I really, from the start, have been a divide-out-the-sacks guy. And unfortunately now, after 12 years of scoring, so they've scored from 2006 to 2017, which is you know, a long period of time, and it would be a significant effort for them to go back. So they've got to do one of two things. They either have to say, a third thing is they can just stick with their system and say, to hell with it, this is the way we believe it's true. But I think they really don't. I think what they either have to break from their system and on a going forward basis use these partial sacks, or they have to go back and redo it, which would be a major effort for them, but right. but would bring their grading in line over the years. So I, you know, it's PFF has been very good, and they're good about not creating modeling Waterloos for themselves. So what I mean is they don't draw a line in the sand and say, you know, this is it, I will never change from this. And hopefully they won't on this as well, and they'll make a prudent change if they come to that conclusion.
Okay. All right. Well, that makes sense to me. If someone else wants to get really nerdy and has more questions about it, they can always hit you up on Twitter at Film Study Ravens to really get into it. But at this point, I think let's use your scoring system and let's look at the offensive line play.
All right, very good.
I'm pretty sure that from what I saw on TV, I think everyone had some of their worst performances, but Ron Stanley did not look like the great Ron Stanley that we've been enjoying.
No, that's true. And Ronnie Stanley has not had as bad a game as he had against the Jags since that four-penalty meltdown in Week 9 of last season versus the Steelers. And just to recap his last year, Ronnie Stanley was great the last 8 weeks of the season, had a tremendous upward trend where his grade and score improved almost every week. PFF rated him as, I think, the best left tackle, might have been just the best left tackle for pass protection during the last 8 weeks of the season, but it was all after that Steeler game where he really imploded.
Right.
Well, this was a game where he faced the ex-Terrapin, Yannick Ngakoue, and he beat Stanley for 3.5 pressures in the game. Stanley did some other things well, but he had an illegal use of hands penalty as well, and that pulled his score down into the high F range for the game. So it was a very bad performance. Hopefully we can blame it on a combination of factors, London being one of them, of course, that won't be repeated. But he needs to step forward in this game against the Steelers and have a big game, because the Steelers have significant edge rush talent, including T.J. Watt, and he'll face some of that in this game and need to be at the top of his game.
Right. We went through all the blames last week. It was London, travel, protests, Peter Angelos, and I think there was something else in there. But yeah, that's all. That's why Ron Stanley had a bad day, and that's also why James Hurst also struggled, right?
Well, you know, James Hurst is on a downward trend right now, and he started off the season with a game you could definitely live with—a nice C, solid C effort. And if he could put up a solid C all year at left guard, it'd be more than the Ravens could really reasonably hope for. But he's reestablished himself kind of at the replacement level these last 2 weeks. Not terribly below it. He had a high F again this week. Similarly, was beaten for 3.5 pressures, a variety of missed blocks, and unfortunately a lot of Hurst's blocks were blocks that missed blocks he was being beaten on. And we've talked about that before. When you move to level 2 as an offensive lineman and then you can't find a block, that's a relatively less critical miss. When you are beaten by a pass rusher, but you're not the guy who gave up pressure because the ball was out quickly, or somebody else maybe gave up the pressure even quicker, then that's really a more serious miss that has more serious ramifications in the long term. So Hurst had 4 of those in this game of his 6 misses, and that's not good. Worked out to be an F after adjustment, and still several points short of passing, about 3. So it wasn't a good game, and he needs to, again, also step forward. I think there is still a possibility James Hurst will be sit down at some point, and maybe Skura and Illuminor will split the guard duties. That's a possibility. But one of the reasons I think that might happen is because the Ravens are now so thin at potential offensive tackle. And watching the Packers go into tonight's game with both their starting offensive tackles out and 3 other tackles that are injured, offensive tackle depth league-wide is so limited right now that I think it's actually more of a chance to take with having Hurst on the field and the risk of him getting injured, and then the Ravens not having a replacement as well. So I think that is a possibility, and his play is certainly nudging them in that direction.
All right. That's unfortunate, but yeah, we haven't even mentioned that this is the first game playing without Marshall Yanda. So
no, we haven't.
This is where we would normally get to Yanda. Instead, let's get to Jensen.
Well, you make a good point about Yanda that I would just want to say is they lost their last emergency tackle option with Yanda. So Yanda's gone to right tackle, and whenever right. he's done that, he's been terrific, but that's not going to happen this year. So now Hurst is the only guy they've got left at tackle who realistically can do it, and it would really be a shame if their depth goes to zero because they're just not being careful about that.
Right.
So. Okay, Ryan Jensen, though, you mentioned.
Yeah.
Had the best game of his career as a professional by a wide margin. He was just simply outstanding. He had 54 plays in the game, made 50 of the blocks. He missed four only. That's not much. He had three terrific highlight blocks. Now, there's highlight blocks that I'll score, and there's highlight blocks. So I'll typically give a player a highlight block when they make a good combination block. Now, just to explain for folks that don't know, a combination block involves usually chipping, or some people call it pinning, a player at the line of scrimmage, often for the center, releasing that player, then going to level two and making a second block that aids on a run play. And Marshall Yanda is the king of combination blocks. But Ryan Jensen made several in this game, and not only was he getting to level two and making those second blocks, he was also creating pancakes in level two. Jensen, more than a lineman I've seen in a long time, really seems to overvalue the pancake block, if anything. And he nearly got himself in trouble in this game. Despite the great game, a high A for the game, no doubt about it, he had a play in the third quarter. Let's see if I can get the time exactly right, just so you see. Yeah, Q3 5:28, where he went into level two, engaged Telvin Smith, who was one of the Jags' top tacklers in this game, drove him back 5 yards, pancaked him. Smith actually fell on his face, and then Jensen fell down on top of him. Then he crawled up further, so his body was completely on top of him. Telvin Smith started to get up, and you know, kind of like a wrestler might get up under another one, and he's on all fours. And all of a sudden, Jensen does a Superman, and I'm talking about the exercise where he takes his hands and his arms off the his feet and his arms off the ground, so all his weight is on Telvin Smith and holding him down. And Smith got very angry at that. Officials came in and separated the two. But that's the kind of silliness that Jensen is going to need to avoid if he's going to be a top lineman in this league. To lead and to be a leader by intellect is what you would hope for out of your center. I do want physicality from him. I don't want stupid physicality of him. He has a long rap sheet of stupid penalties already in a career that he hasn't had all that much playing time, and this is one where it just didn't need to happen. And if it had ruined his score in this game, I'd have felt really bad about it. But fortunately, he didn't get the flag here.
And he's a guy that right now, the way this offensive line is, we need him now more than ever.
Oh yeah, I mean he's arguably our best lineman right now. I mean, Ronnie Stanley is right. Is the guy with the best future, but Jensen arguably is the team's best lineman right this moment.
Yeah, and it must be tough to have your career high, your best game as a career, when so many people around you are having career worst games.
Yeah, I mean there's certainly more bold relief on that, but yes, right. I agree, it would be very difficult.
So, we talked last week that Illuminor might finally get some playing time in London. They made a big deal about the fact that he's going home to London, that he learned about the NFL kind of through the London game. So how did he and Skura kind of shared roles?
Yeah, that's right. So Tony Bergstrom played last week. We went over his performance. He's awful. A .35, got completely out physical, despite the fact that he's a big guy. He really looks more like an offensive tackle who'd be a good pass blocker. Had a lot of trouble with the physicality necessary for the run game, and they sat him down. He's a healthy scratch for this game. They activated Skura from the practice squad and elevated him immediately to the starter. So Skura got 41 snaps. Illuminor got some playing time, 13 snaps. Very nice story that they were able to do that while they were in London. And surprisingly, when I look at both their plays, their scoring comes out very similarly. Now, PFF did not rate either of these guys as highly as I have. And one of the problems is they charged Illuminor with a full sack on a play I don't think he really deserved much. I gave him a third of the sack, but my question was, does he deserve a third of the sack or just a missed block on the play? And they gave him a whole sack, so they really kind of hosed him with one play, because if you give up a sack in 13 plays, you're obviously not going to score very well.
And that's where the 1-0 system hurts.
Yeah, that Yeah, the 1-0 system really didn't make sense for that play. In fact, Stanley, it was a twin sack, so Stanley gave up a sack as well. But the other thing about that play was Austin Howard got beat across the pocket, and that's what really took Joe's focus off from down the field. And as soon as the pocket integrity was lost there, Howard really is the guy, I think, of all three of them, was most responsible for that sack. So there's more detail on that particular play in the article, and I encourage people to go out online and look at that. But I certainly didn't think the responsibility was all to Illuminor.
Right. So that article is on Russell Street Report. So you should go there, search film study, or if it's recent, it'll always be on the front page, and you'll be able to find it.
That's right. Thanks, Josh.
Yeah.
So Skura in 41 plays, 0.79 per play, and it happened that Illuminor was at 0.77 per play, combined 0.79, and at guard that's a C plus. And if you look around the line, we had F, F, A, and F for the other players, so that C plus combined out of Skura and Illuminor looks pretty good. And
Right.
comparatively speaking, you got to be pretty happy with it.
No, C plus is slightly above average, and all we are looking for is average offensive play.
That's right. I mean, if they could get a C out of both guards at this point, we'd be jumping for joy, and the Ravens would be contenders if that would happen.
I agree. Unfortunately, most people did not get at least a C, and Austin Howard did not get a C.
That's right. Austin Howard had a tough game. Now, he was up against Dante Fowler, who's one of the really good young pass rushers in the league. He was a first-round draft pick last year of the Jags, and he got beat by Fowler several times. He held Fowler once and ended up scoring less than half the points per play, so he ended up at 0.49. Even after adjustment, he falls short of an F, but again falls into that high F range. And why do I talk about high Fs? I need to say this for a second. Since there's a very broad set of outcomes in the F, you can get a 20 or a 30, and that's a hell of a lot worse. And Hurst has gotten games like that, for example, against J.J. Watt, than these games from Howard and Stanley and Hurst, where they were fairly close to the pass line, they were just a little bit below it. So I tend to distinguish a high F in that way. But Howard did not have a good game. There's no way to sugarcoat it. And for the first time this year, he was really exposed with a number of pressure events. And he looked slow against Fowler, and he really had difficulty with him.
This offensive line really didn't help Joe, especially for the first quarter, beginning of the game, where Joe was getting contacted on almost every play. How does this line improve and go from here? Is it they just all happen to have a bad day at the same day, or is this really something where we've got to kind of be concerned that this is going to be a regular occurrence, and Joe needs to get out of the pocket?
Well, let's start with this. I am concerned. I the level of talent, particularly at both guard spots, is down, and that makes it harder for both tackles and the center to play well when there's a kind of a weaker player to either side. So I hope they're able to get some of that resolved. Now, we talked about in a tongue-in-cheek way how Peter Angelos and things was affecting things, but I really do hope some of the problems were going to London for the first time, not knowing how to adapt to the schedule there and not being good at that. In another way, I think the Jaguars have just an excellent defensive line, and they're one of the real contenders in the AFC to have one of the top defenses. So their four-man front is devastating, and they did a good job against the Ravens, and give them credit.
Yeah, that's a good point. It is the Jaguars, so it's really hard for us to look at the Jaguars and say, hey, maybe they're a good team. And yeah, they've got Blake Bortles, but maybe they're a good team. And when your defense keeps you off the field that much and allows just the offense to have way more plays than the opponent, even Blake Bortles can look really, really good.
That's right. Yeah, they certainly they kept the Ravens out of the backfield and out of Bortles' face too. And you make good quarterbacks into or bad quarterbacks into good quarterbacks when you do that. And I think you said that in the last show, Josh.
Right. So let's get to the mailbag. You can send in your questions on Twitter using the hashtag FilmStudyMailbag, or send them at FilmStudyRavens on Twitter as well. First one up is BobW1320. What's up with the receivers? No separation, bad routes, or route concepts?
I probably wouldn't be the person to judge whether the route concepts are bad. And once again, I think that the Jags secondary, particularly their cornerbacks, Boye and Jalen Ramsey, are excellent. And so that is going to give Flacco trouble right there. Flacco tried to force a ball into Wallace that was between, as we talked about it, a really good safety and a great cornerback. And to try and force that ball in there, it was going to be a difficult throw, and Ramsey made an amazing interception on the play, and that was one of the picks. The other pick, Boye took it right out of Macklin's hand on the play Macklin got injured. So I wouldn't call either of them terrible picks in terms of Joe made bad decisions. One of them kind of should have been caught, and the other was just an outstanding interception. But I give more of the credit to the Jaguars defensive backfield than I give the blame to Joe on those.
Okay. I wish the TV broadcast would sometimes, when the play didn't work, show you the overhead shot and see what everyone else was doing.
Yeah, wouldn't that be cool if they had the top view available in all plays? We're going to take a little aside here, but say that would just be a wonderful thing to either have on a picture-in-picture on the screen, or if you've got multiple TVs available, or a computer, that you would have multiple right. views available that you could watch at the same time. I would love that. I think a lot of NFL fans would pay money for that on a regular basis.
Yeah, no, I think that's something we will get on the future, where you can, on your iPad, bring up the other displays or something. I'm just going to go with Anderson, 0HR, 0-0 hour Anderson, maybe.
That's what it sounds like.
Any chance the O-line can hold up to let the deep passing game evolve?
Going to be tough. I mean, I think that they need to read the cues properly, but if for the Ravens to get the deep passing game going, they're going to have to go back to some of the things they did in 2008 when Flacco was a rookie to generate time and space. And they used a lot of 2 and 3 man patterns that year, so they would keep in extra blockers. And they could try some of that. I mean, particularly with the Ravens' speed, if they can hold off a 4 or 5 man pass rush with 7 guys blocking, which it seems like you should be able to do, but is actually quite difficult. Oftentimes, additional blockers don't really help as much as you think they would. If they could do that, then yeah, they have a chance to stretch the field, use some of the open space underneath after 3 seconds has run off, and get some underneath throws that are bigger gains as well.
All right. Yeah, and that's that ample time and space that Joe really needs that he's not getting. Mateus Vasquez asks, he's looking forward to this Sunday, so should the Steelers' defensive line be a tougher challenge for this offensive line? My feeling is that for some reason Pittsburgh plays with the fear of losing against us, and they will not be clicking on O and D.
There's something to be said for that. I'll go back to the London thing. Hopefully there was a hangover there that the Ravens are going to be past. But the Steelers have a lot of defensive line talent, and particularly on the inside, they're probably similar to the Jags with Hayward, Hargrave, and Tuitt, who are all very effective and have been against the Ravens in the past. On the outside, they've got dangerous edge rushers. Now, the names have changed, but the skills are still there. Chiquillo and Watt are both good edge rushers and will give the Ravens probably trouble there. So it's a tough-looking front five, and they also have the ability to blitz. Shazier is someone who's a dangerous blitzer because he's so fast. So they have weapons to continually keep the Ravens pressured, and I would expect that they will use those. One of the things that I would look at in terms of are they going to be afraid to lose kind of thing is that they really want to try and control the running game, and maybe they'll give up a little bit against the pass to control the run better, because they gave up over 200 yards against the Bears. And most of the Ravens fans were in such a hangover after last week's games, it was hard to watch that Bears-Steelers game. But the Bears got the ball in overtime, and they rushed 4 straight plays for 74 yards to score a touchdown. And I just cannot imagine what that felt like to Steeler fans. They didn't throw a pass, 4 runs, 74 yards, touchdown.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know. Both teams, they play. You hear a lot from Weddle saying, you're not a Raven. Was it Weddle? You're not a Raven until you beat the Steelers? I guess it might not have been Weddle, but one of the guys, veterans, they hype up for this game on both sides of the ball. So hopefully that does well for the Ravens, knowing that the Steelers also had a bad loss, and they'll be hyped up just as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Steelers lost a game on the road, and the Ravens did too, of course, but the Ravens lost the more important game to an AFC foe. And it seems like year after year, the Ravens come in behind the Steelers in terms of a lot of the tiebreaker category. So that's made it all that much more important that they win this game, because they may have to win both in order to have a chance to win the division from the Steelers. And I know that's, it seems like a long shot and a long way away, but this is an awfully important football game coming up on Sunday.
All right. At Minion Hunter asks, is Joe Flacco hurt worse than we have been led to believe? What is the evidence for that possibility? Is it Joe, the line, the scheme, MM, the running backs, the skill players, a combination, or just a total collapse of the entire system? So he wants to know what's wrong with Joe.
Yeah, what's wrong with the offense? So MM is Marty Morningwig, I assume. But if do I really, can I pinpoint the problem? If I could pinpoint the problem, I could suggest some ways to fix it. The Ravens are going to have to make some changes to scheme on offense, and probably commit more to fewer man routes and slower developing routes to try and beat the Steelers, and also commit to the run game, which means that they're going to have to probably try and get Collins, who looks like their most effective back now, on the field more and earlier in this game.
Yeah, I'm not worried about Joe being hurt anymore, because in week two we really saw him open up and throw the deep ball, which shows me his back is okay. He just didn't have any time to do anything in London.
Yeah, that's. I mean, I think the week two comment is a very good one. That Joe, we already saw that Joe could be good in a game. I did not like the look of the combination sack he took in the game. To take a sack from both sides and one a little lower than the other is always a big risk of injury. And I really did question whether or not he was the same after that. But either way, they're going to play this game against the Steelers on Sunday, and there is no other alternative. Ryan Mallett is not a reasonable alternative to play against the Steelers. And despite the fact that Mallett did finally lead him on a touchdown drive at the end of the game, he threw 9 passes for 36 yards. And you may as well have a running game if you think that's really good. So, it was what it was.
All right, Ken. Well, thanks for doing this. And hopefully we do not have to look at another 44-7 loss together. Mm-hmm. Let's hope that next week when we break down the Steelers, it's a lot more fun to talk about.
I appreciate that. Before we cut off here, Josh, Tell us about your show on 336.
My show is Section 336 at section336.com, and it is a Baltimore sports podcast, Oriole Talk, Raven Talk, or whatever else. We even went to a Baltimore Blast game last year and discussed that together. So we focus a lot on the Orioles because that's where our passion is, but we also cover the Ravens as well because it's me, my brother, and brother-in-law, and we just have a good time talking Baltimore sports.
Okay, and then, great show if you haven't heard it, and they have some interesting guests, but even when they don't have interesting guests, it's an interesting group of people that talk sports.
Yeah, this week we thanked J.J. Hardy for a fun 7 years. Next week, baseball season, we'll start to look at the postseason and talk about some of that, and even without the Orioles, how that affects the Orioles. So, and your writing we mentioned once is on Russell Street Report, and what do you have coming up on Russell Street?
The usual articles week after week. So I do a defensive article and then an offensive line article. Those are the ones we talk about here, of course. And the podcasts are there as well if you want to go backward and listen to any of those. I think most people want their podcasts in a timely fashion. We encourage you to subscribe and download. And Josh, you would understand more about how the subscription method works.
Most people subscribe on iTunes or on the Apple Podcast app. That's your most popular podcast player. If you're doing that, that's great. Go on there, give us a review, write some comments, and give us 5 stars. That helps us a lot. It helps people so that when they search Ravens, we go to the top of the list. But do that in whatever podcast player you're using. If you're using an Android phone, I'm not as familiar, but I know they've got the same situations with apps like Pocket Casts.
Okay, and we appreciate your mailbag questions, so send those to @FilmStudyRavens, hashtag FilmStudyMailbag.
All right, Ken. Well, we will talk on Monday. Have a good weekend.
You too.